Well, yeah, I'll just get started on introducing Jerem then. Jerem's going to be giving the talk today on students and workers and revolutionary change. I'm sure it's going to be a cracker. Jerem has been a long-term activist in the CFMEU and as well as the industrial organiser for Socialist Alternative. So please welcome Jerem.
Okay, I'll be talking a bit about the US student movement, jumping across the Atlantic to talk about France in 1968, coming back to Australia. It's hard to know where to start the story, though. After all, Socrates, back in 329 BC, was complaining, "Our youths now love luxury. They have bad manners, they contradict their parents, gobble their food, and tyrannise their teachers." So I'll skip over just a couple of those 2,000-odd years of youth rebellion. But before we get into the history, it's worth making just a few remarks about the setting in which it happens. And an understanding of social class is really fundamental to this. So assume that, you know, you've been to the other talks in the 101 stream, so you know that you would have heard this phrase multiple times about the means of production. One of the most basic social facts about us is what our relationship is to the means of production. And from that, a whole lot follows. So if you start with the ruling class, the people who actually own or control the incredible productive apparatus that spans our globe, the ruling class, the psychopaths. I don't know whether people have seen that movie by Naomi Klein, The Corporation, and she goes through the FBI checklist of, you know, I think it's six or seven things to watch for that shows that someone is a psychopath, and she compares it to the modern corporation. Reckless disregard for the safety of others, check. Deceitfulness, repeated lying and conniving with others for profit, check. Incapacity to experience guilt, and so on. So, in a pretty literal sense, the dominant economic form that our society, you know, is organised in, you know, that the ruling class reflects in their ideology, is psychopathic. Then we get the working class, who are, you know, were dominated by the ruling ideas of society, of course, but the working class in motion is something else entirely. Of course, the entire productive apparatus depends on our human labour, and overwhelmingly, that's the labour of working class people. So sure, the capitalists, you know, they only control the means of production, but nothing actually moves without us, even in this very automated age. So we say from that relationship to the means of production, the fact that we don't own it, you know, a whole bunch of things follow. Actually, that we have an interest in overthrowing this system. It's their wars, it's their poverty, it's their economic crisis, and we have an interest in doing away with it. It's their racism, it's their oppression, all the rest of it. Not only that, we have the power to do so as workers because of the simple fact that we do all the damn work. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Then there's the middle class who, you know, have a bit of a bet both ways. It's not like they sit on the university board, but they might run the English department. It's not like they're on the board of Woolworths, but they might own your corner store. So they're dominated in turn by the capitalist class, but because of their own dog-eat-dog struggle to survive, you know, the sort of classic petty bourgeoisie has this mentality of, it's not about collective effort. It's not the working class ethos of solidarity. It's all about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Or the more managerial side of the middle class, I suppose, the emphasis is on ideas. You know, ideas rule the whole world. And that, again, flows from their relationship to the means of production. So what's the relationship that students have to the means of production? Your hands going up, nothing. Well, yeah, I mean, partly because actually students don't have a relationship to the means of production. For the time that that students are students, they're declassed. You know, whatever class they come from, you know, mainly nowadays the working class, actually, or, you know, white-collar sections of it especially. A lot of the middle class, of course, the ruling class are represented, but for the time that they're students, they actually don't have a relationship to the means of production. And a bunch of things flow from that. First of all, students can't make a revolution, which I'm sure is no news to anyone here, but was a point of contention in the high point of the student movement in the 1960s. Not only that, but the lack of social power that students have. They can't actually shut down the means of production by withdrawing their labour. It means that student struggles tend to, you know, go up like a rocket and down like a stick. Student organisations and struggles don't have the same sort of staying power as when struggle gets into the heart of the working class. Thirdly, I suppose you can say universities are places where the dominant ideas of society are reproduced, so a crisis in those ideas is reflected very often first on the universities. And especially that's the case, you know, if you look at the 60s and to an extent today, there's this whole ideology of the university, of this free flow of ideas, you know, seeking after the truth and this selfless service for humanity. And then the reality can very often be, especially in this era, overcrowded lecture theatres, rote learning, crap courses, production for profit. You're being, you know, dragooned into being, you know, one little cog in a giant machine. And there can be revolt against that, that split between the rhetoric of campus life and the reality. There's a few other things that flow from students' position in society. It's easier for students to move into struggle. There's less at stake. It's not like you have to walk off the job under the glare of the foreman. You can skip a lecture and, you know, it could be that your lecturer won't even notice. Students generally tend to be younger and therefore have less responsibilities. I remember the first picket line I rocked up to as an organised socialist with my socialist newspaper under my arm, and a guy looked at me, gas workers strike, and I said, oh, okay, what can you do for us? It's a very good practical question that you'll get often on picket lines. Students often don't have to preoccupy themselves. They don't have, you know, multiple mouths to feed, mortgages to pay. Some do, but, you know, by and large, that's less the case. So that's important as well. It's easier for people with less responsibilities to shift into some sort of struggle. And finally, it's possible for students to move with a minority. If you can only get 10% of your factory or your office to go on strike, it's not going to be a particularly effective strike. Whereas if 10% of the 60,000 students here at Sydney Uni, you know, decide to kick up a ruckus, like, the entire university will know about it. And it's possible for them to, you know, the characteristic forms of student struggle. We can't shut down the means of production, so what do? We occupy the administration building, or we have a student strike and enforce that strike to shut the normal operation of the campus down. Okay. So that's enough general remarks. I might start on the history. Before World War II, basically, it's only the ruling class that get through to university. So in that era, if you want someone to scab on a strike, you go to the university. If you want someone to, you know, train to rough up a bunch of communists or whatever, well, you might go to the university for that too, especially here in Australia. All that changes after World War II. You have new industries that need new skills. You need a lot more engineers. You need a lot more technicians. You need a lot more teachers to teach these new skills. You need more sociologists and social workers to adapt all these new workers to the new conditions. So you get an explosion in the university population in a couple of decades after World War II. And of course, they run headbang into a university administration. Well, the universities themselves, you know, capitalism wants everything on the cheap, so the courses are overcrowded, the learning is rote, and so on. And you also run into rules in many countries that pretty much literally come out of the Dark Ages. You know, people, you know, in order to have dinner, you must sit in your academic gown and so on. So this produces a pretty volatile combination. Hard to know where to start the actual history of the student movement, but we may as well start it here. This is a slide that people might have seen, or the picture at least, in the south of the United States. In Greensboro, in South Carolina, four students sit in at a lunch counter. They're protesting against segregation. Of course, they don't get served, so they just sit in, they bring more people, they clog up the entire thing, and soon there's 50,000 people, black students and some white, sitting in at lunch counters across the south of the United States. The struggle goes up in the summer of 1960, it comes down, it feeds into the civil rights movement, into the March on Washington and so on. And one of the things it does is that it galvanises a whole generation of student activists. There's a thing called the Freedom Summer, where the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a black student organisation, invites white activists down to help enrol people to vote in the northern summer of 1964. And it changes people's lives. One of those people is this guy, Mario Savio, one of the most famous student leaders at Berkeley University in California. He is part of the Freedom Summer and, you know, seeing the humiliation, the degradation, the racism that's dished out to African-American people, seeing the heroism of these ordinary people who manage to stay human in human conditions and manage to keep fighting, transforms his life. He comes back to the University of Berkeley, and that October, a lot of students are doing this. There's 30,000 students at Berkeley. Something like 10% of them have been involved in some sort of civil rights activism, maybe low level, maybe petitioning, writing, the segregation in the north as well, especially in employment and housing and so on. But a lot of students have been involved in this. The University of Berkeley, in their wisdom, decide to ban petitions. Like, you know, if you probably seen us, you know, out on the campuses or whatever, with petitions and so on. The University of Berkeley, there's one tiny little area where that's allowed. They decide to scrap it in October. This guy, Mario Savio, protests about it, persists in petitioning. The campus police arrive. They grab one of his comrades, Jack Weinberg. They put him in the car. So that's the scene that's happening here. Mario Savio, spur of the moment, jumps up on the car and says, "We can't let this happen, but I don't know what to do, so let's talk about it." A couple of hundred, literally that's what he says, a couple of hundred students gather around. Within a couple of hours, that couple of hundred has grown to thousands. And they are there for 30 hours with Jack Weinberg and the campus cops sitting in the car. Eventually, Jack Weinberg gets let out. The university sort of relents. 2 months passed, and then Mario Savio and a bunch of people get hit with disciplinary charges. And that is the occasion for the first mass occupation in this era at an American university. It's also the occasion for one of the most famous speeches in the history of the student movement. If I had my act together, I would have had a little YouTube clip to show you. But I'll take you through what Mario Savio says on that occasion. He says, he's responding like some, what he describes as a well-meaning liberal, has described the university as a corporation and the Board of Regents, the governing board, as the board of directors of that corporation. And Savio says, well, if this university is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, the Vice-Chancellor, of this place is in fact the manager, then I'll tell you something. The faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw material. But we're a bunch of raw material that don't mean to be have any process upon us. We don't mean to be made into any product. We don't mean to end up being bought by some client of the university, whether they be government, whether they be industry, whether they be organised labour, be they anyone, we're human beings. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers and upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. On that day, on that day, 1,000 students occupy Sproul Hall that you can see in the background here, and the student movement, as we know it, has really begun. A few points worth making about that speech. It's a hell of a speech. Like, it's one of the great speeches of the 20th century and of this era. There's the alienation of student life. You know, we're a bunch of raw material. We don't mean to be operated on. The contrast between the supposed lofty ideas and here we are being churned out on a sort of intellectual production line. There's the assertion of humanity and the moral appeal of it. It's not a material demand that they're making. It's like to be recognised as human beings in an inhuman institution. There's not this automatic identification of the working class with the working class, which you find especially in the United States. Partly, like the working class in the US at that period, especially, is dominated by these massive bureaucratic machines. Really corrupt union machines. So people rebelling against the whole system, that naturally look to the working class. Mario Savio, actually, a bit of a detail, that day of the speech had joined a socialist organisation set up by Hal Draper at Berkeley. And that's far from the last time that we'll run into socialists playing a key role in the evolution of the student movement. Okay, so that's the occupation. 3:30 in the morning, the cops come in, people are removed. There's a response, a student strike is called, the National Guard get called. This photo is actually from a couple of years later. The National Guard becomes a regular fixture at Berkeley and other American campuses during this period. That's Sproul Hall in the background. But a month after this, sort of occupation by basically the army, the Chancellor is fired and the free speech movement declares victory. Now, that organisation disbanded, but the activists, including Mario Savio, that powered it and who had been radicalised by it and who had been won that, oh my God, we just changed the world, did you see that? Say, okay, the next thing is Vietnam. And it's really the movement against the war in Vietnam that powers the entire student movement around the world in this period. I'm not going to talk about it. You know about the 2 million, 3 million, 5 million dead. You know about the napalm. You know about more bombs being dropped on Vietnam than on the entirety of Europe and the Pacific. You know about the hypocrisy of, proclaiming this war for freedom and democracy while there's, vile, obscene racism at home. And by 1968, you know the fact, everyone in the world knew the fact, that the Americans are losing this war. From the Tet Offensive that happened in January of that year, they got to, you know, the grounds of the American embassy. Okay, it was beaten back, but everyone in the world knows this slaughter is for nothing but empire and profit. So, you know, an incredible radicalizing event. Now, I could talk for, you know, hours about the evolution of the US student movement, but this same war, we're going to leave America there, we'll come back briefly. This same war is radicalising people on the other side of the Atlantic. And this is the scene in Paris on May Day 1968, a section of the traditional May Day rally, very strong workers' movement dominated by a Stalinist Communist Party. Turns out every May is pretty conservative every other day of the year. Vietnam solidarity is a feature. Note the cobblestones in the picture. They'll come in handy later. Okay. Very often it can seem that struggle just falls out of a clear blue sky, like, you know, without anyone predicting it. And that certainly seemed to be the case in France in 1968. The New Year's address that Charles de Gaulle, the 78-year-old president of France, had given that year, talked about, what did he say? I greet the year 1968 with serenity. It is impossible to see how France today could be paralysed by a crisis as she has been in the past. The Economist, just actually in this week of May Day, celebrated the pathetically weak state of France's unions. And André Gorz, this world-famous sociologist, this was his take on it. Basically, because everyone had a washing machine, there was going to be no strikes. And in his words, it's unlikely that in the foreseeable future there will be a crisis in capitalism so acute that in order to protect their vital interests, workers will resort to a revolutionary general strike or armed insurrection. As an apocryphal story, I tried to confirm it, that book, or a book containing those words, was held up on the printing presses in May 1968 in France by the world's biggest general strike. Certainly proved him wrong. Okay. It's not just idiot sociologists, though, that were having a hard time seeing anything coming. Like a lot of the left, the student left in particular in France, was like, well, what's going on here? You know, like things are kicking off in Berkeley. You know, they've been going for a couple of years. Everything's shit in France. People are apathetic and so on. At this time, there was only a tiny minority of students protesting. Like, you're talking a couple of hundred at the key campus where things really kicked off, Nanterre University, which is sort of like Macquarie. It's not Sydney University, it's not the Sandstone. It's like, you know, big suburban, built in the 60s type university at Nanterre. There'd been a struggle to desegregate the dormitories there in 1966. That had failed. There'd been a strike by sociology students in late 1967 involving a few hundred students. That had failed. You know, important struggles, like never write off the small struggles, because it was those struggles where a group of activists found themselves, learned some skills and cohered themselves and learned some political lessons. So you can see the stirrings of revolt happening. This same group of activists, of course, was heavily involved in Vietnam activism. And when a number of them were expelled for participating in a protest that got pretty militant in the middle of Paris, then they had a small occupation at the end of April. A further protest by the students about that. Only 200 students at the protest, but the chancellor of the university overreacted and shut down the entire campus. And the point of doing that was to try to isolate the militants and get the mass of... Again, it's one of the great things about students. You can move into quite militant action without a big number of students to back you up. But the chancellor is trying to call their bluff. Okay, now all these students who weren't involved are going to put pressure on you, the political students. Our exams are coming up. We've been studying for years for this. You know, you're going to sacrifice our exams. That's what he was trying to do. The response of this little group was to move to the Sorbonne, the Sydney Uni of Paris, I suppose, and to continue their protest there. And again, this massive overreaction from the authorities, who called the cops, beat people up, mass arrests, and then shut the campus down. And quite spontaneously, and to the surprise of the activists, students started fighting back. Oop, which way am I going? So in the early days of May, you had a cycle of protests. I don't actually know what date this protest is from, I'll stand for the protests, where students were coming out protesting, demanding the release of four youth, just local youth who got caught up in the fighting at the Sorbonne and were quickly jailed, and they wanted the Sorbonne reopened. And the daily protests and daily repression. And the repression... like, it looks something like that. Like, they don't muck around, the French riot police. That quite regularly, like, you know, a couple of times a year, there are strikers killed, working class, migrants especially beat up, students brutally repressed, and so on. Okay, France, the birthplace of democracy, blah, 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 was a very, actually, authoritarian regime at that time with President Charles de Gaulle. There was a lot of stick being given to student protesters. Student protesters, sooner or later, start to lever up the cobblestones and chuck them back. So there's a cycle of protest in early May. There's daily protests going on, leading towards a big Friday night rally that's been called on May the 10th. On the night of May the 10th, 20,000 students rally and they occupy the Latin Quarter right next to the Sorbonne, not far from the Sorbonne, and say, OK, we're staying here, we're occupying this space. And they start building up barricades, which is the... Is this the barricade? It is a barricade. This is actually one of the last barricades to fall. So they're just grabbing anything. They're supported by the local population. There's working class youth who know what it is to be harassed and beat up by the cops. They start coming in from the suburbs and building barricades as well. So there's a standoff develop. 2 a.m, the riot police go in. And by this time, the whole of France is listening to the confrontation develop. There's opinion polls taken in this week in Paris, by the way, that show that 80% of the population of Paris support the students because of the sheer brutality that the police are dishing out. So people listening to the radio, a well-known former soccer commentator was reporting the events for one station. And this is just a gem of a book. If you haven't read Ronald Fraser's oral history of the revolt of 1968, you really should. Okay, so this is the radio station commentary. Now the CRS are charging. They're storming the barricade. Oh my God, there's a battle raging. The students are counterattacking. You can hear the noise. The CRS are retreating. Now they're regretting. That's the riot cops. That now they're regrouping, getting ready to charge again. The inhabitants, the residents of the Latin Quarter, are throwing things from their windows at the CRS. Oh, the police are retaliating, shooting grenades into the windows of apartments. At this point, the radio station, which had been telling the commentator over the air not to dramatise events, interrupted him. This can't be true. The CRS don't do things like that. To which the commentator responded, I'm telling you what I'm seeing. And his voice went dead. That cut him off. Millions of workers all over France listened to that. Not only had there been, working class youth finding their way in, not only had, small socialist groups been taking numbers of workers from factories and so on in to be part of the student protests, but, people respect strength. Working class people respect strength. My God, these cops have been giving us batten for years. Finally, someone bloody stood up and did something about it. Just to give you an idea of the scale, this is the scene on just one of the streets in the Latin Quarter the morning after. And this is the scene of students being led away by the riot police. It's really like a scene from an occupied country. The workers' movement up to this point had stayed out. The Communist Party that dominated the workers' movement described the student protesters as sons of the bourgeoisie. Just in a couple of days' time, they'll give up protesting and go and manage daddy's firm. So, all this idea of students and workers uniting, this was definitely anathema to the Stalinist Communist Party. But their own membership and the dynamic of the struggle, the popularity of the students and so on, forced them into calling a one-day general strike. So it's a Friday night, the night of the barricades, they call a one-day general strike for the Monday. And this was the sort of crowd that resulted. I don't have any French, but I'm told reliably that the banner says, workers and students, if we unite, we will overcome. And, no one can count the number of people, hundreds of thousands. People were expecting, some of the student leaders were saying, well, we get 20,000, the Communist Party will bring a few, we'll be all right. Maybe it was a million. No one knows. The entirety of Paris was thronged with students and workers and so on. Not only that, but in the face of this demonstration, the authorities reopened the Sorbonne and released the four working-class youths who'd been jailed. So it had won this massive victory. The supposedly invincible Charles de Gaulle government had been beaten, and it had this incredible effect. First of all, they occupied the... the students occupied the Sorbonne. They grabbed a piano from somewhere, set it up in the central quad or whatever, started playing jazz and drank wine and partied all night. Then started, or stuff that, we've just had this experience, we're occupying the entire campus. So, Trotskyist organisations, tiny political organisations, grabbed lecture theatres and started putting on meetings about, the history of the workers' movement, the role of students within that, the conservatism of the Communist Party, explaining the world. And having had this experience, thousands of students especially, but just general people were turning up and being part of these discussions. At first it seemed that that was all that was happening, and then a couple of days after their strike, a small news item about an occupation of a factory in the west of France, in Nantes, an aerospace factory, where there'd been significant fighting, actually, with the cops on the day of this protest. And it's a few hundred workers, but, you know, some of the young workers have been really stirred up by it. They've got local grievances. They go marching around the entire plant, hauling everyone out, grab the manager, shove him in his office, lock the door, grab a stereo, put the Internationale on high rotation, in their words, so that he could learn the words without any ideological effort. After 24 hours, they get sick of the tune themselves, and it's like Top of the Pops or whatever, but, you know, something just happened. That's a few hundred workers. Within 3 days, 3 million workers were on strike. By the end of the week, some say 11 million workers were on strike. The biggest general strike that happened spontaneously from below under the impact of these incredible events. That's another shot from the same protest. Okay. Many of the factories were under occupation. And spread to all sectors of society. You know, you probably heard some of the stories. The headquarters of the Football Federation is occupied. The manager's locked in his office, and the footballers hang a banner saying "Football for the footballers." The giant car company Berlier, the workers take down the enormous letters outside and put them back up so they spell "Liberté." The morning starts in all of these places, and in many workplaces that weren't on strike. Such as schools, you know, there's a daily assembly which then starts to talk about, well, what are we learning? Why are we learning it? What's the purpose of it all? Let's try something else. The entirety of society is plunged into this revolutionary ferment. In some cases, of course, the workers occupying the factories decide to restart production under their own control. Only a small minority of places do that, but it's an important indicator of the dynamic of that struggle. Now, the forces that dominated the French labour movement were absolutely horrified at this event. This was not their plan. This was not what... You think Joe Stalin and his gulags is the version of socialism that you're fighting for? You are not going to be impressed with this sort of activity, you know? And they kept the strike as passive as they could. It was clear that it was spreading, so the Communist Party would start pulling out workers, but no, don't occupy, we'll just send you home, so you're isolated and anonymised. Okay, you're already occupying your factory. Well, we won't have an elected strike committee. We won't have daily assemblies. We'll just leave people, you know, bored with no activity to try to outlast the strike. This is a scene back on the university. Jean-Paul Sartre talking to a packed lecture hall. This was like happening, you know, all day, every day. These are some of the posters, which you can, I think for $5, you can get yourself a slice of history, that were produced by art students during the Paris days, and all became iconic images. This is the view inside the Renault factory at Billancourt, which is a suburb of Paris. State-owned factory, 10,000 workers. They go on strike on the 16th of May. On the 17th of May, a small Trotskyist group, the JCR, leads a demonstration of students in solidarity with them. They want to fraternise with the revolutionary workers. You know, like, this is what it's all about. They are met by locked gates and rows of Communist Party shop stewards barring their way. So, look, if you want it on a postcard, this is it. You don't wait for a revolutionary crisis to break out before building a revolutionary organisation. You know, like the fact that there was no revolutionary organisation inside this workplace, the fact that there was no one organised to take on the dominance of the Communist Party was basically the death of the strike. On the 27th of May, which is when this photo was taken, it would have been this meeting. And the government tries everything. We'll try repression, and, you know, the repression just doesn't work. They say, okay, De Gaulle calls a referendum. I'll call a referendum on my authority. If I lose, I'll resign. He can't get the freaking ballot papers printed because all the print shops are on strike. He tries to take it to Belgium to print them there. The Belgian print workers say, no, we're not touching it either. Okay, plan two is gone. Like, they try all sorts of things. Eventually, they pick up the phone to the union officials. We'd better negotiate. What they negotiate is a 35% increase in the minimum wage. The union officials take this back to the Renault factory and they're, comrades, glorious victory, 35%, back we go. One account of the meeting says that they are met first by deafening silence and then by a few scattered boos and catcalls and then a whole chorus, 10,000 workers shouting their officials down because they've been part of something. They don't want just a pay rise, they had a taste of freedom, they had a taste of what it is to actually be human, what the students were talking about. But The Communist Party has a whole apparatus of loyal shop stewards. One of the accounts of one of the oil refineries that eventually got talked back to work by the Stalinist Communist Party, it says, you know, the workers were cursing, they were shouting, they were screaming at their officials, but eventually they complied. And at factory after factory, that's what ended up happening. Okay, so really, France 1968 is the classic case of the students acting as a detonator to much more serious social forces, which can not only disrupt a campus or an entire university system, but can actually threaten the stability and even the existence of capitalism. There's versions of this that play out in country after country after country in this period. You know, student uprisings important to overthrowing repressive regimes in Greece in 1973, in Thailand in 1973. There's a version of this that happens in Italy, which actually lasts for a decade before the authorities manage to restabilize things. You know, time after time, it's this explosion on the campuses, and then students are consciously reaching out to workers, and you know, workers being inspired by what the students are doing that produce some version of this. France is the, like, it's where it went the furthest in terms of the possibilities of revolution. But capitalism survived. Okay, this is a scene in Japan. I just don't have time to go through any of it. Meanwhile, of course, the student movement is developing in the United States. People might have heard yesterday, this is the Kent State shooting, 4 students shot dead by National Guardsmen, 2 black students shot dead at Jackson State University just a few days after this. 4 million students go on strike across the United States in protest against this. This is a time in 1970. Opinion poll showed 1 million university students described themselves as revolutionaries. I should come back to Australia before I finish up, because all of these events obviously have their parallel and had an extraordinary influence on Australian society as well. This is like the early 60s, you know. It's easy to be dismissive of small struggles. Oh, you only get a few people. God, you can only fill one bus. How pathetic. Well, stuff that. It's these small struggles that students were involved in against the White Australia policy, against capital punishment, against the, you know, like obscene racism faced by Aboriginal people that cohered a group of activists that became central to these movements that transformed Australian society later on in the 60s and into the 70s. This is a bunch of Sydney University students about to get on a bus with Charles Perkins to tour the segregated regions of New South Wales, bringing a lot of attention, desegregating the Moree Pool famously, and so on. It's from movements like these that scenes like this evolved. This is actually only in 1966. This is quite early. The Australian government commits to Vietnam, reintroduces conscription in late 1964. Early 1965, they say, yep, we're sending people to Vietnam. But this is when Lyndon Johnson visits, the American president, which is towards the end of 1965. And already, Sydney Trotskyist Bob Gould, who some people here may have known before he passed away a couple of years ago, like, in contrast to the very conservative approach of the Communist Party of Australia, that was everyone must wear suits, we'll petition politely, we'll walk through the streets, he was like, nah, we're forming a Vietnam Action Committee and we are going to lie down in front of this mass-murdering president's motorcade. And 5,000 people in Sydney in late 1965 turned up to do that, and these were the scenes that resulted. So already you're getting quite a radicalisation. Really the high point in Australia is 68 and 69. In 1967, on July the 4th in Melbourne, there was a silent candlelit vigil against the war in Vietnam outside the US consulate down on St Kilda Road. In 4th of July 1968, the Monash Labour Club turns up and they are prepared to fight. Every window in the consulate is smashed. Like, it's like, you are killing millions of people and you complain about smashed windows? And that was really the climate of the times. This is a picture from 1960, same thing happening in Sydney. And there's, I mean, you know, there's the Battle of Sydney where they stormed the recruiting office. This is a protest against Roden Cutler, the governor of New South Wales, who came to inspect the university regiment. And a bunch of students protested. Of course, it wasn't uncontested. Right-wing students hoed in and badly beat a number of students. That's one of the prettier photographs. Monash University was one of the centres of the radicalisation. People from Monash would recognise the glorious architecture of the Ming Wing over here, the Menzies Building. And this is one of the student general meetings against the expulsion of students for their involvement in anti-Vietnam protests. So you're talking thousands of people. This is a scene again at Sydney Uni for the, I think it was the 1971 moratorium. All of this is starting to impact on the working class. Actually, in Australia, it was the workers who moved first. It was the Communist Party-led unions of the seamen, the seafarers, and the Waterside Workers Federation walked off the job in protest about when the involvement in Vietnam was announced in 1965, were banning supplies going to Australian troops as early as 1967. But really, the core of the activists and the dynamic of the campaign came from the students. Okay, done that. Yeah, so it got to a point by November 1969, after the My Lai massacre was exposed, and this is like an entire village, like everyone in the village being killed by US soldiers. Men, old women, and children, and babies. Yes, and babies, just slaughtered. Came to light in November 1969. 300 union delegates in Melbourne passed a resolution which called for, I quote, "The united action of the entire trade union movement to force the repeal of the National Service Act. We encourage those men already conscripted to refuse to accept orders against their conscience and those now in Vietnam to lay down their arms in mutiny against the heinous barbarism perpetrated in our name upon innocent aged men, women and children." So you've got, like, the trade union movement actually calling for mutiny in the armed forces. Obviously, it's the parallel situation that developed in the United States and the reality of mutiny in the United States Army, as well as the heroic resistance of the Vietnamese themselves, that leads to the scaling down of the ground involvement and ultimately to the victory for the nationalist forces in Vietnam. The same activism fed into other areas, of course, into the Springbok tour, the race of South African team. We'll come back to them. Okay. By 1972, though, the movement is on the downswing. And so it's probably fitting to talk about the political legacy of these movements. Obviously, I mean, in a lot of ways, like things that we take for granted today, the right to hand out a leaflet in the streets of Melbourne was won during this period. Radical students went to jail, went to Pentridge Prison, simply for handing out a leaflet on Melbourne City, on the streets around Melbourne. And they defied it, the unions got involved, the council ban was lifted, and, you know, today we can do that freely. The ability just to, you know, like, it's still great when you have a rally, but it's not exceptional. The moratorium rallies were denounced by the Premier of Victoria. Anti-war protesters are political bikies pack-raping democracy. There was just this hysteria about the idea that masses of people could take over the streets and sit down. All of this has been, you know, breakthroughs were made by the anti-Vietnam War movement in that time. A lot of the campus radicals, of course, eventually students do tend to graduate, it's true. And a lot of the people who've been radicalised in these movements then found themselves in all sorts of industries. And so, you know, fairly tired old unions such as the Teachers Federation, even the Insurance Union, white-collar unions and so on, were radicalised and turned into a real force in the workers' movement by students radicalised through these struggles. And, of course, there's a political legacy on the organised left as well. And that's where the legacy is a lot more unfortunate because at this time, like, you know, thousands, tens of thousands are calling themselves revolutionaries for the first time. But the organised political options about, like, I'm a revolutionary, what do I do? The organised political options for them was either the staid old Communist Party, wear a suit, you know, don't grow your hair, march down the street in this dull sort of shuffle. Not very appealing. Much more appealing were the Maoists, who had this whole, you know, street fighting militancy to them. And, you know, there's an attraction to it. Except in 1972, like, it's not actually a socialist regime. And at the time, look, this is just nitpicking, who cares, whatever. Well, it matters when your hero Mao Zedong in 1972 meets with the archdevil Richard Nixon, they shake hands and make a deal. And so an entire generation of socialists and militants, people who have been drawn into the struggle, are just totally disillusioned with that. Like, there's a minority of people, like Tess Liak, who's here at this conference, was one of the people who was battling it out with the Maoists at Monash Uni, in the early 70s and saying, no, this is not socialism. You are being misled. This is a dead end at best and so on. But there's a tiny minority. It was important that minority was there. And that's what we're building on today. But that minority simply wasn't big enough. By 77, the Chinese Communist Party is saying every class-conscious worker in Australia should vote Liberal. By 1989, of course, the Chinese regime is annihilating its own student protests in Tiananmen Square by rolling tanks over them. So an entire generation, like, you wouldn't have had a revolution in Australia, but you could have come out of the late 60s and the early 70s with a serious revolutionary working class organisation based on that radicalisation. And the fact that revolutionaries weren't organised enough in advance means that we've lost, we're still scrambling to take up that ground. That's our task. Okay. I'll finish in a sec, but I just want to talk about today, because it's not just all, the glory days. Students in France, still plenty of students in France, not only in 1968, but in 1986, in 1995, in 2005, they turned out in the streets in their hundreds of thousands, they shut down the country and they beat back, economic reform of the universities. They still pay some of the lowest fees in the world in France because of their militancy. This is their rally just earlier this year. And you can see the ghost of 1968, the little logo up there. On this occasion, again, it was reform of the universities, the planned privatisation of the railway. They weren't successful in stopping it, but the tradition lives on. This is in Britain in 2010. Some of the first people to move against the austerity of 2008, 2009 were the students. Managed to totally horrify the Duchess of Cornwall and her companion there. Always good to see. Here in Australia, things a little bit less rowdy, but the waves of student protests that rebuilt a campus left, actually, in the late 1980s. This is one of the scene just up the road at University of Technology Sydney with their visiting government minister when the Labor government was abolishing the free education that had been abolished. Today, this is the scene at Monash University. It's not 10,000 students, crammed in front of the Ming Wing. This is a rally that our comrades organised and got a lot of people involved in, a couple of hundred there, in defence of the Bunnick family, a family of academics who come from Bangladesh on visas. They had a 12-year-old kid. Oh, my God, the kid is autistic. So Peter Dutton, immigration minister, this is a possible charge on the state. This is a risk that the Australian state can't take. It was many people in this room, actually, who initiated it, who kicked it off, who got other people involved, and caused enough of a stink that the Bannock family is actually still in Australia today on permanent residency. So you can still have an impact. The most recent, we'll call it a wave, little wave of student protest on student issues was in 2014. And again, it was like the horror budget of 2014, which attacked health, education, social security, you name it, was cut. When the budget was released, the education cuts were severe, but they were hardly on the public agenda. It was student protests like these ones in 2014, and again, socialist alternative members, a lot of the people in this room had a lot to do with getting these protests to happen. And looking at the polls, in terms of issues of concern in the budget, education goes from down here to up here. They caused enough of a political stink to actually stop that, so-called reform from going through. So the old stuff still works. This is one of the more famous scenes. I think some comrades in Sydney getting acquainted with the Q&A program, which is usually a bunch of bores sort of boring us all with just platitudes. And the students actually cut through. They just got into the bloody place, hung a banner the wrong way round, got it the right way round. The entire country was talking about it. So, even that level of activism still continues. I don't have a slide for the less glamorous side of it. I was asking a couple of comrades, do you have a picture of people doing a stall? People just handing out a leaflet, engaging people in discussion. Here's a worldview. Can we interest you? And so on. That is the real bedrock. Day in, day out. We love the stories of the 60s. We love the stories of the high points. We're waiting for that next wave to hit. But in the meantime, we're going to have all sorts of political activity that keep us ticking over. Just like in France in 1968, struggle is going to come seemingly out of a clear blue sky again. And again, the question is going to be asked, are we ready for it? I'll leave it there.